It's a wonderful call to all of us to remember who we really serve. Well, we're going to move into our morning session. Before we do that, the spouses session will be starting upstairs shortly. Amber Brantley, who you heard from last night, Jenny Roberts, who you also heard from last night, and Becky Thompson, David Thompson's wife, have a program arranged for this morning for the spouses that would like to take advantage of that. Spouses are more than welcome to stay here if you would like and enjoy the CME and CEU session as well. I'm pleased to invite Kent Brantley to come back up to the stage, and he's going to be speaking to us about an overview of viral hemorrhagic fevers.
Okay, good morning. Good morning. It's hard to follow a talk by Dr. Cheatham about God's call with the discussion of viral hemorrhagic fevers, but we're going to give it our best shot. My goal over the next 35 or 40 minutes is to provide an overview of viral hemorrhagic fevers, their causes, and then specifically, we'll look at Ebola. I hope that what you can take away from this is a better understanding of some of the various causes of hemorrhagic fever, viral hemorrhagic fever, and an understanding of some of the basics of Ebola, its transmission, and the basics of caring for patients with Ebola or other viral hemorrhagic fevers. I want to start this talk by saying I am a family physician. I am fellowship trained in obstetrics. It's my favorite part of medicine, and that has very little to do with hemorrhagic fever. The only thing that qualifies me to give this talk is because I'm that guy. And over the last year, and really in the 6 months leading up to, or the 3 or 4 months leading up to July of 2014, I learned a whole lot about viral hemorrhagic fevers. A little bit of on-the-job training, you might say. So I'm going to start with a case. This is a real case of a patient that I took care of. Normally, when you give a case presentation, the timing is not that important, but I want to set this in a time frame for you. This was at the very end of May of 2014, and the setting is in Monrovia, Liberia. 34-year-old man came to the emergency room late in the evening complaining of 1 week of stomach pain. When I tried to assess his history, he said he had had this generalized stomach pain that had been worsening over the last week. He had been having a decreased appetite. He had fever. But his pain was very nonspecific. It wasn't, he could not define it any better than that for me, that my stomach hurts. He had no vomiting or diarrhea. I asked about sick contacts. He had not been around anybody else who had a similar illness. I asked about travel history. At this point in time, Liberia did not have any cases of Ebola, but our neighboring countries of Guinea and Sierra Leone did. So I was very certain to ask patients about their travel history, especially to those neighboring countries. And he denied any recent travel, except that he worked in the town of Buchanan as a carpenter. Buchanan was southeast of Monrovia, which is the opposite direction from anywhere that Ebola was or had been. And he said he had never had an illness quite like this before. That is about the extent of the history I was able to gather across our cultural and language barriers between myself and this patient. So I moved on to the physical exam. The patient was febrile, tachycardic, mildly hypotensive, and he was breathing fast. He was a thin, muscular, healthy-looking guy, except for his mild distress, as evidenced by his vital signs. He was coherent. He could answer my questions. He could speak for himself. His head and neck exam was really unremarkable, except for his eyes being injected in red. He didn't have any lymphadenopathy or nuchal rigidity. His chest exam showed clear lungs and a normal, fast heart sounds. When it came to his abdominal exam, which was his chief complaint, he had generalized tenderness with guarding, but no rebound, no focal tenderness. I couldn't get any focal tenderness at his liver or gallbladder or where his appendix normally would reside. But when I lightly percussed his back, his lower back, he gave a rise, and he had CVA tenderness on both sides. His extremities were cool and clammy, but his capillary refill time was within normal limits. So I ordered some laboratory tests. His hemoglobin was 11.4, and you might say a 34-year-old man who looks healthy with a hemoglobin of 11.4, that's a warning sign for something. And it might be, except in a place where malaria is endemic and diet is not often what would be best for maintaining ideal health. A hemoglobin of 11.4 wasn't unusual. I recognize that it was a little lower than it ought to be, but that's not really a specific finding for anything in our emergency room. His HIV test was negative, and his MS, his malaria smear, was negative. I checked a urinalysis, which in our facility was just a urine stick dip test, and it showed white blood cells, positive nitrites, positive leukocyte esterase, and positive bacteria. It was dirty urine. That's about as specific as we could get. And you might say, okay, this patient has abdominal pain. What about his other lab tests? What about his chemistry profile or his liver function tests? And those would be really nice, but remember, we're in Liberia, and these are the tests you get in the emergency room. There were some chemistry tests we could order, but you can't order a Chem-14 or a Chem-8. You might be able to get a potassium. You might be able to get an AST, but it depends on what time of day it is, and this was Saturday evening. And it depends on whether the air conditioner in the lab has been working properly all day or not, as to whether the machine will run or not. And at this time, this was the extent of our laboratory testing available. So I began to come up with a differential diagnosis. At the top of my list, I thought this otherwise healthy man, I think he might have pyelonephritis with sepsis. He's got dirty urine, CVA tenderness, and a fever with SIRS criteria. I think he has pyelonephritis with sepsis. But he could also have severe malaria. And you might say, well, you said his malaria smear was negative. And I did say that. But as Lance Plyler can attest, I never doubt malaria. I learned in my few months in Liberia to never doubt malaria, even if the test was negative, because that test was operator dependent. It required the lab technician to make the slide and look at it under the microscope and report what they saw. So there could be operator error with that, and he could have severe malaria. He could have typhoid fever with a bowel perforation, with his generalized abdominal tenderness with guarding. We don't have a good test for that in Liberia. And if you have a good test for that where you're working, I'd love to know about it. He could have appendicitis with rupture. We always think of these rare, weird tropical diseases because we're in Liberia, but normal stuff happens there too. He could have appendicitis. Peptic ulcer was on my list. We saw a lot of patients with peptic ulcer disease who would come in with generalized abdominal pain from an ulcer that was eroding through their stomach. You may say that none of these quite explain every finding this patient had, and that would be correct. But maybe it was something that maybe there was something else going on that we couldn't think of. So this was my differential diagnosis, and I began treating a patient with aggressive IV rehydration and broad-spectrum antibiotics, which in our facility meant IV ceftriaxone. I came back to evaluate the patient after a few hours, and I noticed he had twitching of his facial muscles. And I thought that was not a good sign. So I was able to get a lab technician who was on his way out of the hospital to go back and run a potassium for me and a glucose. The potassium came back elevated. Let me give a disclaimer at this point. I reconstructed this case from my memory, so some of the details are not precise, but they're accurate. His potassium came back at something like 6.1, which is high. So I went back to my differential diagnosis and said, how does this fit in? Well, he could have pyelonephritis with sepsis, just like I expected, and he could have renal failure. That first urine specimen that we got was a catheter urine specimen, and when I reevaluated the patient, I noticed he hadn't made any more urine despite our aggressive IV rehydration. So could he have pyelonephritis with renal failure and sepsis? Or could this be something different? Well, I continued our aggressive IV rehydration and our antibiotics, and I administered dextrose and insulin because that is all we can do for hyperkalemia in Monrovia. I moved on because I was on call for the weekend for the whole hospital. I had other patients to tend to, other cases to see. I came back to reevaluate this patient after the treatment I had initiated, and I found that his twitching had progressed to more of a muscle spasm, almost convulsions. We treated him again with the dextrose and insulin, and I gave him some IM diazepam, hoping that that would help relax him a little bit. I didn't think he was having seizures, but I thought it might help sedate him in his state of extreme suffering that he was in. As I reevaluated the patient again through the night, with night turning to morning, as he spasmed and convulsed and clenched his jaw, I started to notice some blood in his saliva. And I started to notice bleeding from the injection sites from the IM diazepam. And I thought, this is not a good sign. And I went back to my differential diagnosis, and I thought, could my diagnosis still explain this? Well, severe sepsis can cause a patient to go into DIC, which can cause them to bleed. It was still a reasonable explanation. And my treatment options were rather limited. But I wondered, could this be something else? Because I was on call for the whole hospital, I had to consider other patients that were coming in. And we had another patient come in the morning hours who was a pregnant patient. She was near term, and she came in with eclampsia. She was post-ictal. Her husband said she had just stopped seizing before he brought her through the door. She was also bleeding from what a quick ultrasound showed was a placenta previa. That's an emergency. That's a true emergency. And as I prepared the operating room crew, I called Dr. Debbie Eisenhut, our general surgeon, to assist me with what I was concerned might become a very complicated C-section. And as we were preparing the operating room and we were waiting for the patient to be prepared, I discussed patient number one with Debbie. And I said, Debbie, I'm worried. I have a really bad feeling about this guy in the emergency room. And I wonder if we maybe ought to think about considering that it's possible maybe that he could have Ebola. And that's a really uncomfortable thing to say when you've been treating a patient in your emergency room all night long. And Debbie said, well, let's treat him like he does until we figure it out. It's a pretty good move. So we proceeded to the operating room, and we put patient number one in strict isolation. We put the partitions around his bed. We told the nurses, do not touch this patient until we come out of the OR. It was clear at this point that his condition was deteriorating, and despite our best efforts and exhausting the very limited resources we had to treat his condition, we were not going to be able to do anything to reverse the course of his illness. So we proceeded with C-section, and during the surgery, a nurse came to the operating room to inform us that this patient passed away in the emergency room. This was the first time we got to initiate our protocols for dealing with a patient that we suspected of having Ebola. And we put on our personal protective equipment, and we moved the bed from the emergency room out into our courtyard, and we wrapped the body up and sterilized everything with bleach and sent a specimen off to the Ministry of Health to find out 2 or 3 days later that this patient died of Lassa fever. Lassa fever is one of the several causes of viral hemorrhagic fevers. It's an arena virus, which is one of the families of viruses that are known to cause hemorrhagic fever. Arena viruses are transmitted by rodents. Lassa fever virus is thought to be transmitted through the droppings of mice and other rodents. Other causes of viral hemorrhagic fevers include Bunya viruses, like the Hantavirus that we have here in America, and Rift Valley fever. The filoviruses are the ones that have gotten the most attention lately, Marburg and Ebola. And if you ask anybody about viral hemorrhagic fever these days, that's the one that everybody's going to be able to name, is Ebola virus. Filoviruses are now known to have a reservoir of in the bat population in Africa. The flaviviruses, including yellow fever and dengue, are transmitted by insects, mosquitoes. And then there are the paramyxoviruses, which unless you are researching causes of viral hemorrhagic fever, you may never come across Hendra virus or Nipah virus. At least I hadn't until I was trying to put together a presentation about viral hemorrhagic fevers. But those viruses also are known causes of viral hemorrhagic fever. That patient we took care of at the end of May, who died of Lassa fever, was kind of our sentinel event to get us back in gear, recognizing the threat that we really were under of Ebola coming to our facility. And it was actually just 1 week after this patient died that we received our first Ebola patient at Elwha Hospital. Samaritan's Purse began partnering with SIM to provide personal protective equipment, the Tyvek suits. We began receiving volunteers to help us staff our Ebola treatment unit, and we began engaging in the care of patients with Ebola virus. The rest of this talk will focus more on the details of Ebola virus, and I'll share a little bit of our experience at Elwha along the way. Ebola was discovered in 1976 near the Ebola River in Zaire, for which the virus is named. The largest outbreak before this current outbreak was in Uganda in 2001. And if you look at these case numbers, 425 cases with 224 deaths, that was a big Ebola outbreak. 224 people died, and it was the largest ever since 1976. But compared to the current outbreak, it is a drop in the bucket. These numbers are actually a little out of date. They're from about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and the numbers have increased a little bit since that time. But over 28,000 cases of Ebola have been diagnosed in West Africa since March of 2014, and 11,300 people have died. 11,300 people have died of this disease that in the past had never killed more than 224 people in a single outbreak. If you've been following the headlines, you may have read just this week that the WHO has acknowledged that just in the week ending on October 4th, for the first time since March of 2014, there were no new cases of Ebola diagnosed in West Africa. We praise God that we've reached that milestone, but it's not over yet. The outbreak, as it started in Monrovia at the beginning of June, increased pretty rapidly. For the first couple of weeks, we had one or two patients at a time, but then it became three or four, and then our five-bed unit was full. And Samaritan's Purse activated a disaster response team. Lance Plyler came to Liberia, and Samaritan's Purse took over the management of the treatment center in Lofa County in the northern part of Liberia. And then we soon took over the management of patients in the Monrovia area on behalf of the Ministry of Health as well. I want to talk about this picture for just a second to give you an idea of what it really is like to work in an Ebola treatment unit. This picture, I'm on your left, and one of our Liberian nurses, I believe that's Elvina, on the right, holding a clock. We're taking the patient's vital signs, but you notice there's no stethoscope because it's really hard to hear with a stethoscope through the Tyvek suit. You have to wear it on the outside of the suit. And none of us, we tried it a couple of times, and nobody was proficient at being able to hear anything meaningful with the stethoscope. So we did blood pressure by palpation, and we just got a systolic pressure on patients. The clock being held by our nurse here is because there's no other way to keep time. You don't have your watch that you can look at to time a patient's pulse. And we had partitions between the beds to provide some bit of privacy to the patients. And so there was no central location in the room where we could hang a clock that could be seen from every bed. So as we rounded on patients, we would carry a clock, a wall clock, with us from bed to bed, and we'd have to wipe it down with bleach in between patients. And wiping down things with bleach shortens their usable lifespan quite a bit. So the blood pressure cuffs worked for the first month, maybe. And after that, they began falling apart. And it became even harder to take a patient's blood pressure. And the clock got a nice film on it. It was hard to see the second hand sometimes. And all of this is being done wearing the personal protective equipment, the Tyvek suit, inside a cinder block building in Liberia where it's sweltering hot and the humidity is higher than the temperature, and it makes taking care of patients a challenge. But that patient, I can remember his name. I remember that his sister brought him some socks with clover leaves on them for good luck. And she wanted us to give him those socks, which we put on his feet for him after this picture was taken. And it's because he is a person made in the image of God that it is worth any bit of trouble to provide him with the best care we possibly can, to show him the love of Christ, to pray with him, to pray over him, and to serve him. As Jesus said, when you saw me sick and in prison and hungry and naked and a stranger, you took care of me. And we ought to remember that these people that we see, maybe more than us being Jesus to them, we are having the great honor of serving Jesus in them. But back to Ebola. As I said, the reservoir for Ebola is the fruit bat. Up until this current outbreak, this was always theory. And now there's been some more firm evidence that indeed the fruit bat is the reservoir for Ebola virus. Nobody really knows how common this is in bats. It must certainly not be terribly common or difficult to transmit. Otherwise, we would be seeing outbreaks all over because of the contact between the human and bat populations in Central and West Africa. But the main mode of transmission, once that virus has entered the human population from the bats or from an animal that has been infected by a bat, the main mode of transmission is human-to-human transmission. It is the spread by direct contact with the bodily fluids of a sick individual. I want to repeat that again. The main mode of transmission, the major mode of transmission in any Ebola outbreak is human-to-human transmission by direct contact with the bodily fluids of a sick individual. That's why the personal protective equipment is important, and that's why in the majority of cases it works to prevent infection from patient to caregiver. There's been a question raised during this outbreak is, could Ebola be airborne? And you probably heard a lot of experts testifying to Congress and speaking to the public to say Ebola is not airborne. It's only spread through contact with bodily fluids. I would say the answer probably is, could Ebola be airborne? Probably. But that's not the major mode of transmission. When we talk about airborne transmission, we're talking about, can the virus be transmitted in particles or droplets that are small enough to be carried on air currents across the room more than 6 feet? So to say that's impossible with Ebola, I don't think we have evidence to prove that that is impossible with Ebola. But what we know is the major mode of transmission is direct contact with bodily fluids. So you might be able to prevent airborne transmission of Ebola by wearing a purified air-powered respirator or other kind of extreme measures like that. But if you want the most bang for your buck, if you want to make the biggest difference in cutting transmission, it's things, it's not trying to stop airborne transmission. It's trying to stop the spread by direct contact with bodily fluids. It's providing healthcare workers with gloves, because so many healthcare workers in places like Liberia are working in frontline clinics, taking care of patients who come in suspected of having malaria, and they have no gloves to wear when they take care of this patient. And then they find out after the patient dies that, oh, that patient had Ebola, and they had no way to protect themselves. So I just want to drive home the point that the major mode of transmission is still direct contact. And we can let the researchers investigate the likelihood of airborne transmission. But in the midst of the battle, what we need to be worried about is barrier precautions that are accessible to the people who need them the most. The incubation period of Ebola, as you've all heard over and over the last year, or at least a year ago, you were hearing it a lot, is 2 to 21 days. And I want to stress that that's the incubation period. That means the time from exposure to the onset of illness. And that is all that 2 to 21 days means. This is not a 21-day illness. You're not contagious for 21 days after you get sick. It doesn't require isolation for 21 days. There have been a lot of misconceptions about what this 21-day window means. And it's just the common incubation period. On July 23rd, I woke up sick, and I called Lance and said, I'm going to stay home today and work from home this morning. And he said, call me back at noon and let me know how you're doing. And by noon, I was febrile and feeling worse. And 3 days later, I tested positive for Ebola virus disease. And my colleagues and friends took care of me in my home for 10 days before I was evacuated to America. And this picture was taken by Lance Plyler on his cell phone, looking through my bedroom window on the evening after I received ZMAP. This was in the hours after receiving that experimental drug, as I started to stabilize and improve a little bit and was able to sit up in my bed. And that stable condition lasted 60 or 72 hours, just long enough for my evacuation to occur, for me to get into Emory Hospital, where I could be cared for by the team there. The foundation of care for Ebola, as well as most other viral hemorrhagic fevers, is supportive care. We've seen a lot of advances over the last year in novel therapies for Ebola, but the foundation is still supportive care. I received ZMAP, which is a 3-antibody cocktail targeting the Ebola virus, and it is one of several drugs that have been in trial in West Africa. And I have a feeling that because of the time it took to get these drugs to trial, most of the data we receive back out of these trials is not going to be statistically significant, because the case numbers were decreasing by the time the drugs got to trial. But what has been done throughout this outbreak and in every previous outbreak is to provide supportive care for a patient. This means strict contact precautions, IV fluid resuscitation to prevent dehydration, electrolyte supplementation, because as we've learned this time around, being able to care for patients in America and test their laboratory, find out their electrolyte numbers and all of that, is that we have electrolyte derangements in Ebola, including hypokalemia, hypoalbuminemia, and some other problems that come along with those two issues. So electrolyte supplementation is important. And I have a question mark after this next one: presumptive and empiric therapy. In the past, it has been the rule that every patient being treated for Ebola in an Ebola treatment unit receives empiric therapy for malaria and other bacterial infections. Because there was no way to test for those things, and they could be compounding factors on top of Ebola virus, making a patient more likely to die. And so we treated for those problems. The reason I have a question mark is because I think this may change as the ability to do laboratory testing on patients with Ebola increases. And when I arrived at Emory and they were able to test me for other diseases, they stopped all medicinal therapy and just supplemented my potassium and provided me with IV hydration and pain medication. I didn't receive any more antibiotics. I didn't receive any more anti-malarial medication. And I think the protocols may reflect that change as the ability to do laboratory testing on Ebola patients increases. But the foundation of caring for patients with Ebola virus is still supportive care. There are several vaccines that have been in trial in West Africa, and some of them have shown promising initial results. And I think those vaccines are going to be the key to preventing future outbreaks of the magnitude we've seen this time around. But they're not the answer to stopping this current outbreak. There's still too much to learn about them to say that they are going to be the answer for ending this current outbreak. And then there are novel approaches, like I've mentioned, antibodies, the short interrupting RNAs, and other antiviral medications that have been tested to see if they might have an effect against Ebola. Ribavirin has been used and is effective against Lassa virus, but evidence says it's not effective against Ebola. And all of these novel approaches are still experimental. We don't have proven data saying that any of them are known effective therapy against Ebola. This is a picture of part of the team that took care of me after I was evacuated. They've gathered outside my house after doing some of the decontamination work to pray for Nancy Reitbol and for me. And I will always thank God for that group of people who took care of me in my greatest time of need. So the conclusion that I want to leave with you is, number one, the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa is not over. I told you about the headline this week from WHO, but until we have had zero cases in the entire region for 42 days, the outbreak is not over. And as we've seen in Liberia and in areas of Sierra Leone, it's likely that for some time following the zero case mark, we'll see a case pop up occasionally, maybe transmission, sexual transmission from a survivor to a partner, and that's going to have to be dealt with. And we've seen Liberia deal with that very well, to respond quickly, to identify and trace the contacts, and to isolate the case. And we pray that Guinea and Sierra Leone will be able to follow suit in increasing their level of awareness and prevention and their response time to cases of Ebola. The next line, the best way to combat this outbreak is to put an end to the virus in West Africa. I think the point here is that we need to get over our xenophobia. We need to get over our self-centered focus, and we need to go to our neighbors who are in need and help them where they are, and not just try to protect ourselves where we are. And I want to remind you at the end of this talk to consider why you went into medicine in the first place. A year ago this time, this country was erupting in panic as there had been a case of Ebola diagnosed in Dallas, Texas. And it was next weekend, a year ago, that the news came out that one of the nurses who had cared for that patient contracted Ebola. and we were all consumed with fear. And I tried to preach a message at that time to say we need to allow compassion to trump the fear that we're feeling. But that's not just true of Ebola. That was not just true a year ago. I think this is true as we respond to God's call on our lives, that we're afraid of a lot of things, and fear can be a deterrent to following God's call on our lives. But Christ had compassion on us, and he's called us to have compassion on those around us. And so as you encounter disasters like the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa, or when you encounter disasters like that patient in your clinic who has a problem list as long as your arm, and they always take more than their 15 minutes in your clinic, and you're entering that encounter, whatever your situation, remember that Christ has called us to love our neighbors as ourselves, to have compassion on people in need, and that needs to trump everything else. That needs to trump our fear. It needs to trump our comfort. It needs to trump our convenience. So remember why you chose a career in medicine, and remember the calling that God has placed on your life. Thanks for your attention this morning.
Thank you very much.